the start of the week and plenty on your radio today. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
But Michelle, did you wake up one morning or did you hear and say, I want to give one of my, I want to donate one of my kidneys?
No, I've always donated blood, and I've given 50 donations. Then I got osteoporosis and they won't take it then. So I just thought of, well, I've got two kidneys, why not try that?
I always felt a sense of kinship with the Russians around me at this time of year. I feel quite alienated for the obvious reasons. And I suspect a lot of Russians do too.
And I recognised the back of his head. And the reason I did was because I'd seen him in countless movies. His name was Alec Guinness.
Ah.
And there were two people on the radio today talking about donating a kidney to a stranger. We'll get to Dr. Chris Fitzpatrick later and his chat with Ryan Tuberty. But we'll start with Michelle McGowan, who called Joe on the live line in the afternoon. Michelle is definitely my new hero.
Michelle McGowan is from Lucan in Dublin. Michelle, good afternoon.
Hi.
And congratulations.
No, I don't think so, needed.
And how are you feeling today?
Brilliant, yeah. It's 8 weeks tomorrow since the operation.
And the operation was you gave away.
Yeah.
You donated a kidney.
My kidney, yeah. Because I have two and I didn't need two of them.
And when did you decide you wanted to?
I've been trying to do it for the last few years and contacting the Beaumont Hospital. But we don't do in the South donations to strangers. So eventually last summer they said contact Belfast City Hospital, and that's what I did. And then the process started and COVID delayed things a bit. But within 8 months of contacting them, I had donated a kidney. So it was terrific.
Well, just explain that to our listeners. In the Republic, you cannot donate a kidney to a stranger who would need it, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
Why not?
You can only donate to friends or family. And so they've been trying to sort it out and get it that it can be done, because it can be done in the north, but nothing was happening. Each year I rang, they were still hoping it would happen. And so by last year they said to me, look, I contact Belfast City Hospital, and they're well sorted to do it. And it's a very easy process, very easy operation to go through, but very easy for someone from the south to get up there. Trains and then two more stops and you're outside Belfast City Hospital. It's just, I'm ringing to both get the South to get it together that we can do it, but also to encourage people to think about doing it up in the North, because it really is very easy.
But when you say you can donate in the South to a friend.
Yeah.
So it's not a medical issue. Friend and they go through all the tests.
Yes, of course. I don't know what's stopping this, but it's you can't donate to a stranger.
Well, a stranger, according to the Irish saying, is a friend that you haven't met yet.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So if you were... No, I'm not being facetious. I think it's incredible what you've done, and we'll go through it in a sec. But I'm not being facetious when I say the law down south is an ass when it comes to kidney donation, because they're saying if you had found out that Paddy or Mary Morphy needed a kidney, and we know people who need kidneys need them, need it. If you had said, well, I'll befriend Paddy.
Yes, exactly. It could work that way, because then if you didn't match Paddy, you could be putting the chain.
Now,
and then you could do it that way.
But Michelle, did you wake up one morning or did you hear and say, I want to give one of my, I want to donate one of my kidneys?
No, I've always donated blood, and I've given 50 donations. Then I got osteoporosis and they won't take it then. Even though my osteoporosis had gone down to a different level, you can't do it. So I just thought of, well, I've got two kidneys, why not try that? So I can, and I gave it, because it's very easy, to be honest, Joe. When you don't have family, it's easy to make that choice, and I didn't have no children, so it was just a matter of going up and sorting it out. And really I looked on it as an adventure with hopefully a good outcome at the end of it, that they would accept my kidney.
And Joe asked Michelle about the operation.
You're going under a general anaesthetic.
Yeah.
How long does the operation take?
About 3 hours. And yes, there are risks involved, but thankfully I was of a good height and or good weight,
So in good health. They've done a huge amount of tests on me. And I just felt very happy. Really, nothing was going to stop me once I had started the process, because I really wanted to do this. And I was healthy enough and had no other reason not to
Incredible.
Do it. So, no, I don't think so.
I
but
know,
anyway.
Obviously you don't.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Even, I remember I was knocked down 10 years ago and I had to, when I was taken to hospital, blah, 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 and then I was going under surgery and the anaesthetist said to me, you have to sign this or your exarchaean has to sign it, because there is a risk when you're getting a general anaesthetic.
Yes, yes. And there's a risk, like, for my future health, if I have to get any medications, I have to tell them that I've only one kidney and I'm not to put on weight, because otherwise I could develop diabetes. But anybody, that could happen to anybody. Now, there was a 1 in 3,000 chance I'd die.
Oh,
but I didn't tell anyone that till after the operation.
A 1 in 3,000?
Yeah, I think that's a wee bit high, I thought, afterwards.
Did the outsider that won the Kentucky Derby on Friday, I think he had longer odds.
Yeah.
One in 3,000 you could die.
Yeah, I was
die.
A bit surprised at that, all right. But I felt very safe. They've been doing it a long, long time up there. And they were very comfortable with how the kidney looked. And everything went very well. So I just, you know, prayed and
okay,
hoped.
Okay, so you
best.
Go up. Give me the logistics. Do you drive up, bus up?
No, in fact, that's why how simple it was. I was able to get to a bus into town and from Conwy Station train up to the Belfast. And then from the station, you're allowed to go free to another station, 2 stops down on another train. And then it's only a 5-minute walk from the train station to the clinic.
Yeah.
So it's very simple to do. And so I had 6 visits up and down the hospital. First of all, they want to make sure that you're of sound mind and you want to do it and you're motivated. And then you meet...
Michelle, who does that interview?
The coordinator up in Belfast.
Okay, is that a psychologist or...?
No, now they did talk about me seeing a psychologist, but they hadn't been doing that for a while and then they were quite happy that I didn't need to.
So they went through. How long did that process take?
That's only like an hour's chat.
Okay,
really.
And they get a sense from you.
Yes, okay. Where I'm coming from.
And do they ask about next of kin?
Yes. And took next of kin details and made sure that you have backup support, like so that my 2 sisters were able to feed me and my friend stayed in the house. He looked after me.
But so. Michelle, did they say, did you need the affirmation of your next of kin?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No. And then you go up and you talk to the consultant nephrologist, and you go to another day, you meet the consultant that's going to do the procedure. Oh, and there's another day before that, you do a whole day. They put you up in a hotel the night before, and then you do a whole day of tests. And they're very well organised, bringing you from one space to the other to get everything checked up. And then another day, so in total 6 visits.
And were the tests intrusive?
Like blood tests and scans and stuff.
Okay.
And then another test was, then they bring you up. Once they found the match, they brought me up to do another test to make sure that the 2 of us were compatible. So at least it meant they had a good chance that it was going to work when the person got the kidney. And then there was another visit where I had to go up. When I went to the consultant, I also had to see an educator who goes through all the risks with you as well.
And Michelle's sister, Grania, called Jo.
Tell us about this woman, your sister.
Well, the researcher asked, was I surprised? And no, because you described her as a giver, and that's what she is in everything that she does. So no surprise. Was I happy? No, I wasn't.
Okay.
I was worried. But not sorry now. I think it's great.
And when did Michelle tell you, Grania, that she was going to donate?
I was probably one of the first that she told, because she knew I'd be more accepting than maybe others. But
And what were you worried about?
Well, I was worried that she'd be one of the 3,000, though I didn't know that until she just said it on the radio. I didn't know you were going to ring her on you. But that's just the way she is. And I mean, our big worry was that if she needed a kidney in the future.
Okay.
But I did say I wouldn't see her stuck. But I would, if I was going to give a kidney, it would only be to a friend or relation. I wouldn't give altruistically, like she did.
And why, when you say Michelle is a giver, what is that? I presume you grew up with her, and was she always this way?
Always, always, always. Like, there's six in our family, six children, yeah. And Michelle was the eldest. But she'd be like, when we'd all be looking for the nicest bun to take or whatever it'd be, she'd wait till the end.
Oh my God.
She's not an Aegis, but yeah, that was the way she was.
But you know, especially if you're close in age, the row, the fights on a Saturday night when you discover, or Michelle discovers, that you're wearing her new jumper or new blouse or whatever.
Oh, that really wasn't a thing, but you could be sure that if it was, she'd have offered it to you, or she'd have bought you one. If she thought it was something that you really wanted, she'd buy you one.
And did your parents, did they recognise this altruism in their eldest?
Oh, absolutely. We all do. She's very special. She's one in a million.
She really is. Michelle McGann and her sister Grania on the live line with Joe Duffy. And after an historic election in Northern Irish politics, Professor Jim Ferriter was talking to Claire Byrne in the morning.
Well, inevitably there were headlines going around the world about the Sinn Féin success. And them becoming the largest party is obviously an event of huge political significance. But I think even beyond the numbers of seats and the percentage of the vote, though that's significant, there's an emotional element to that for many who are associated with the Republican project, including those who have been involved for decades and who feel that this is a huge breakthrough for them. And I wouldn't underestimate that. Of course, it's also about historically the revision of the Sinn Féin project over many decades to the point where they accepted that they would have to work within Northern Ireland to try and achieve their political aims and the acceptance of consent. And even the idea of being involved in the governance of Northern Ireland obviously involved a revision of the Republican project. So there have been various stages to it, north and south, over the years to get them to this point. But it's of huge significance. But what's also changed, of course, is not just the balance of power, but the political complexion. And that presents us with a very, very interesting picture and a whole series of dilemmas. You also have, I suppose, a reminder, unionism is not down and out. It's not finished. The DUP, I think Geoffrey Donaldson will probably be a lot happier with the results than he expected to be a couple of weeks ago. And there will be many in Northern Ireland who in a few months may well feel that very little has changed at all, because the prospect now is of a very long standoff. But I think when you were looking at the evolution of Northern Ireland, and you remember the speech that was made by David Trimble almost 25 years ago about historically it being a cold house for Catholics.
Yeah.
But I'm also really interested in the rise of the Alliance Party. It's not an overnight success. The Alliance Party is 52 years old this year, which I think sometimes people forget. And you'll appreciate going back to the early 1970s when it was established, Oliver Napier and Bob Cooper, who came from, you know, different traditions and different religious identities and were seeking an alternative. Now, they were a pro-union party in those early days. They got it in the neck from the SDLP, who said they were just trying to promote this unionism for middle-class Catholics. They got it in the neck from Ian Paisley, who said they were traitors to the union. And interestingly, Oliver Napier had come to prominence as an advocate of integrated education in the late 1960s. And his argument, consistent argument over the decades, was that you had to bring people in Northern Ireland together, that you couldn't go over their heads to try and come up with a solution to the problem of Ulster. And, you know, it's been a very, very long journey for the Alliance Party to try and find a support base that's much broader than the few kind of middle class constituencies where they were able to make some inroads.
Perhaps it just needed the passage of time to happen.
Well, not just that. They also needed to reposition themselves. And it's very interesting to look at their own complexion and the kind of younger activists who were involved, and even the recognition of greater diversity, sexual orientation, all of those different areas. So this election has, I suppose, also revealed a difficult irony for the architects of the Good Friday Agreement, including the SDLP, who were once again are asking themselves that question, what do we stand for? Where do we position ourselves? The Ulster Unionist Party has had five leaders in the last 10 years. You know, Doug Beattie talks now about an agile unionism. What does that mean now in 2022? Where do they find a political future for themselves? So there's a lot of interesting narratives going on under the headline of the Sinn Féin trial.
So the moderates who might have traditionally voted for those two parties you just mentioned may have drifted to the Alliance now?
Well, I suppose many in the Ulster Unionist Party did not consider themselves to be moderates, and there was a huge struggle within the Ulster Unionist Party to get them to accept the idea of the Good Friday Agreement. And you remember all the struggles, the internal struggles that David Trimble had. But certainly that's where Doug Beattie is looking to distinguish the Ulster Unionist Party from the DUP, a progressive unionism, an agile unionism. He struggled, of course, to hold on to his own seat, which is an indication of the mountain they face. And even for the SDLP, what does the Labour Party or the Labour part of their title mean anymore? I mean, if you go back again to Gerry Fitt, the founder of the party, one of the founders of the party, when he parted ways with the party in the late 1970s, what concerned him was that the SDLP had become too green, too Republican, that they were no longer, as he put it, the voice of concern when it came to social issues. And we heard a lot during the election about social issues being a priority, economic issues being a priority for the electorate. So the SDLP, it has been struggling for a long time now as to where to position themselves. But there's also going to be the question of London and how politicians in Northern Ireland deal with London now. We talked last year about the centenary of the creation of the state of Northern Ireland. The very first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, James Craig, his biographer, Hugh Sherman, talked about him being in that position at the very foundation of the state. And one of the lessons that he learned straight away was that London was not to be relied on. And it raises this interesting question, which both Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley, now gone, used to refer to as the challenge of self-determination. Even representing their respective constituencies, can we come together for self-determination purposes? In other words, you don't want to be reliant on London. And like we've had these almost desperate pleas from Ian Paisley Jr. now to Boris Johnson to be the unionist we need you to be.
Mm-hmm.
And Boris Johnson, as we know, doesn't bring an intellectual or ideological consistency to anything.
Professor Dermot Ferriter from Today with Claire Byrne. And on Morning Ireland, as the Russians have their annual military parade to mark the end of World War II, it's called Victory Day, an insight into Russian life and the war on Ukraine. Here's Rachel English.
The Russian President Vladimir Putin will preside over a huge military parade in Moscow today. The annual event marks victory over the Nazis in World War II. However, this year's parade falls under the shadow of the war in Ukraine. Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor is in Moscow and joins us on the line. Fred, as I was saying, this parade takes place every year. How different is this year's event likely to be?
Well, outwardly, it's meant to be the same. It's a little bit smaller scale, but not significantly so. There'll be lots of armored vehicles and missiles and 10,000 troops marching across a Red Square. But of course, as you said, it takes place in the shadow of this new war. It's on everybody's minds. It's right there. It's the proverbial elephant, I guess, in the room. And it will overshadow everything, even if nothing explicit is said about it. But so, yes, and say for me, I've lived here a long time. Many of my relatives, my mother, my uncles served in the Canadian Army in World War II, and I always felt a sense of kinship with the Russians around me at this time of year. I feel quite alienated for the obvious reasons. And I suspect a lot of Russians do too.
Because it is worth remembering on this day that an incredible number of Soviet citizens, including Ukrainians, of course, died in World War II.
Yes, of course. Yes, it is the great earthquake of the 20th century. And this part of the world, it feels like it was just yesterday in some ways. It still shapes politics. And of course, the Russian government, Soviet government, and the Russian government following it has used it as a source of legitimacy, because it is the one thing that all Russians from all walks of life and political viewpoints do agree upon, that defeating Nazi Germany was a good thing. So it's hard. I don't know whether Vladimir Putin will try in some way to reconcile that move, those historical memories with what's happening now. I think we have to wait and see.
Presumably, he's going to have to say something about Ukraine, and there's already a lot of speculation about what that something might be.
There's a tremendous amount of rumor and gossip that there always is in this country. It is the motherland of gossip. The rumor that he will declare war on Ukraine or announce full mobilization, those rumors are out there, but they've been explicitly denied by the Kremlin. So probably that's not going to happen. And so we're just left to wonder. I think it's just a couple of hours to go, so we'll wait and see what does happen.
Mm-hmm. And what are you expecting him to say?
I really don't know. I know that the official narrative is that what's happening, that the enemies that they're fighting in Ukraine, not the Ukrainian people, but Nazis, the reincarnation of Nazis. This is, and they can parade prisoners from like the Azov battalion who are festooned with swastika tattoos and such. And there's other like pieces of evidence that are brought out in Russian propaganda. But obviously I don't buy that. It's historical nonsense to me. Some Russians seem to, possibly Putin will make some effort to substantiate that claim.
Fred Weir on the Christian Science Monitor talking to Rachel English on Morning Ireland. Then later on today with Claire Byrne, Alexander Rodnianski on the current situation in Ukraine.
As you've been hearing this morning, Russia is celebrating Victory Day with a show of military might across the country while its army battles Kyiv's forces in the east of Ukraine, where 60 people were killed in an airstrike on a school sheltering civilians. And I'm joined on the line by Alexander Rodnianski, who's advisor to President Vladimir Zelensky and also Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Cambridge. Good morning, Alexander. Thank you for joining us again on the programme.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now we'll speak about what's been happening in Russia and what's being said in Russia today at the Victory Day celebrations. But President Zelensky confirmed, as I was saying, that 60 people who were sheltering in that school in Luhansk were killed when Russians bombed it at the weekend. That school, what do you know about what was happening there? It's where I think most of that village, the people who were left in the village, were staying.
That's right. Well, they were sheltering in the school. There were about 90 people. And as far as we know, 60 have been killed, 30 have been rescued in a completely indiscriminate attack by the Russian side. That's all we know. I mean, it's bloodshed and horror, as always.
And in Mariupol, 170 civilians successfully evacuated from the steel plant. They've arrived now in the town of Zaporizhia. We know that in total, 600 people have been evacuated. But how many more are left there? Do you have any idea?
Well, we have a rough understanding. There were about 1,000 civilians, 2,000 military personnel. So we've rescued some amount, but there's still plenty left.
And the Ukrainian fighters who are still there, they've criticised the government, the Ukrainian government, saying that it had failed in the defence of Mariupol. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a dire situation for our defenders over there. We've tried to give them all the support possible, given the situation that we're faced with. And, we're continuing our efforts to rescue everyone that we possibly can. But ultimately, it's the Russian side that decides what will happen, whether they just want to wipe them off the map, the surface of the earth, whether they want to annihilate all the remaining people that are staying there or not.
What happens when those people are evacuated? Is Mariupol lost to Ukraine at that point?
Well, it's hard to say, but obviously the situation isn't good for Ukraine. It's dire. I mean, those people have been surrounded for some time. The Azov steel plant is the remaining portion that we control of the city. So once that's no longer under our control, then yes, you could claim that Russia has taking full control of the city, but whatever remains of it. I mean, ultimately, they've destroyed the city entirely, in its whole entirety. So you can't really speak about a successful conquest when there's nothing left of the city.
Yes, and I want to talk to you now about what's being said in Russia at those Victory Day celebrations, because some had expected that Vladimir Putin might use today to try and repackage the war in Ukraine in some way. Now, there wasn't a formal declaration of war. How significant is it that he did not make that type of announcement?
Well, it's sort of significant, but also to be expected. We know that a general mobilization in Russia would have been extremely unpopular. Many revolutions happened in Russia, in particular the revolution at the beginning of the 20th century. The big revolution happened after a mobilization during World War I. So that was hugely unpopular, and Russia's leadership knows that from history. So they haven't been, you know, very adamant about declaring a full-scale mobilization in a state of war, which would entail that. So that's not too surprising at the end of the day. And also, it's not surprising for the reason that it's not clear what more troops would bring. I mean, he could obviously, you know, send more people there, but those people aren't particularly well-trained. They've already burned and destroyed some of their most well-trained troops. And so that's not clear from a militaristic perspective either.
Alexander Rodnianski from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, in a beautiful ramble of a conversation, Ryan Tuberty was talking to former master of the Coombe Hospital, Dr. Chris Fitzpatrick, traversing lockdown, loss and Sir Alec Guinness. Chris was also talking about publishing his poetry collection.
So we've got so many places that we need to go. You've brought this beautiful collection of poetry called Poetic License in a Time of Corona, which the title itself I really love. Normally I'd begin at the beginning, but I'm actually going to go to a scene that really struck me, which is there was a time when we had the 2 kilometre limit of where to walk, the radius, and then it said you can go 5.
Yes.
And you took a stroll somewhere that you could have gone any day of the week until this thing came along, and it became almost biblical in its beauty. Tell me about that.
So I was longing to get to St. Stephen's Green, and being a Dub, excuse me, when you walk through Dublin, I've got to walk through St. Stephen's Green, and it's such a beautiful space. Yeah. And whether it's the spring or the summer, the autumn, winter, it's a delight to walk through. It's like the song, the Noel Purcell song, Dublin's just like heaven, with a stroll through St. Stephen's Green. So I was really chomping at the bit to get into St. Stephen's Green. I became like a holy grail because it was beyond beyond the distance that we were allowed to travel when we were stuck at 2 kilometres. So I kept saying to my wife, look, I need to get into St. Stephen's Green. And the first weekend that the restrictions moved from 2 to 5, we walked into St. Stephen's Green, and it was a beautiful spring day. Like, the sky was never as blue. There were no clouds. We walked in kind of the main gates, like the grass was so green. The flowers were so colourful. Like, the fragrance was almost overwhelming. And it was almost like stepping into an Impressionist painting. So as we strolled down that central boulevard, except for the 2 metres apart, it looked like a painting, and like I was half expecting like Renoir or Manet just to pop out of the bushes and to paint us. And then like I heard this kind of thrush sing, and like I suppose you're in a kind of a heightened sense of excitement and joy to be actually free, to be actually in a beautiful space. And it kind of sang to me kind of that kind of line from you too, it's a beautiful day, don't let it get away. Yeah. And it was such a beautiful day, and I wanted to kind of hold on to it, just to preserve it. And then I kind of imagined that Bono and the boys were going to pop out of a bush and accompany the song thrush. And that line, it's a beautiful day, don't let it get away, was kind of a little soundtrack or a little mantra that ran through COVID for me. So whenever the sun shone, or whenever I heard the birds sing, or whenever something beautiful happened, I would hear that little soundtrack. It's a beautiful day, don't let it get away.
Yeah.
And Ryan asked Chris to talk about his brother Declan, the Liverpool superfan he lost last year.
So Declan was 3 years younger than me, and he was a school teacher, and he was also a passionate Liverpool supporter, like passionate written in big font. He was also very religious, which was, I suppose, uncharacteristic for I suppose, people of his age nowadays. He would have that type of religious devotion that my parents had, a lot more religious than me. So, and he was a school teacher and he taught English. And that was a kind of a point of common interest for both of us. And he was absolutely perfectly well up until he collapsed at work about this time last year. And he was transferred into hospital. And within 24 hours, he was given a diagnosis that he had metastatic cancer with brain secondaries. And he'd really no symptoms up until that period of time at all, been perfectly healthy. And he asked how long had he left to live. And they said like maybe 3 to 4 months. And he had a little bit longer than that in the end. And he was offered chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and that was palliative. And this was the time of the cyber attack as well. So
and the HSE.
And the HSE. Yeah, yes. So his radiotherapy was actually given in 3 different hospitals because there were kind of connectivity problems in relation to it. And he got very sick shortly after his commencing chemotherapy. And basically, he went home to die. And his wife, Septa, took, who was a teacher as well, just took time off work. And she looked after him so marvellously well. But some of the family were waiting to get vaccinated. Others weren't vaccinated and yet. And we had window visits. We had restrictions on house visits. He, over a period of months, lost kind of basically all of his bodily functions, except he was compos mentis towards the end. He was very resigned to the fact what was going to happen to him. I suppose at a moment, and it was a challenge for him and a challenge for Septa and all of us. And out of the blue, he received a letter one day from Jurgen Klopp.
No.
And he was a huge Liverpool fan. This was a personal letter written to him. Somebody had obviously contacted the club. And actually before that, he'd got an email from the club to say, you know, wishing you all the best. We heard that you're sick. And it was kind of signed off by the management and team. So that was very nice. He was delighted to get that. But to get a letter in the post from Jurgen Klopp, and it was like a poem because every word is perfect.
Lovely.
And it finished with the line, "You'll never walk alone." And it was like a ray of sunshine that came into his life. And it was so powerfully meaningful for him. Brought him such joy, brought all the family joy. And I'm a Manchester United fan, and you know, I would kind of hold Jurgen Klopp and the team in very high regard.
Yeah.
And then after he died, the chaplain of Liverpool football team wrote a letter to his wife, just to say, "Remembering you." Wow. And I thought that was pretty remarkable.
Very, very thoughtful. Yeah, yeah. He was obviously a young man.
He was 61 years of age. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And to be predeceased by your younger brother must be just all wrong.
Yeah, my parents, and they're listening in. So hi, Mum and Dad. And my mother's 89 and Dad is 90. So that was particularly kind of difficult for them as well.
I can imagine.
But he was looked after wonderfully well by his wife. We had an opportunity to discuss things together in relation to our childhood. So I'd been in the same room as him for about 27 years. And we used to play this game, like, what's your favourite footballer? What's your favourite movie?
Yeah.
What was the best holiday you ever went on? And and I wrote a poem about it as well as Jurgen Klopp. One of the questions I asked him, and this was not long before he died, what's the best book you ever read? And he said to me, "The Remains of the Day."
Oh, love
and,
it. Yeah.
And that kind of stopped my heart for a moment and kind of, I knew what that meant and he knew what it meant.
Yeah.
And I want to just capture that moment because I suppose they were the saddest things that happened to our family, the death of my brother. And it was hard to, I suppose, kind of rationalize it at the time. And I wanted to preserve his memory. And also, I think those reading the book will, you know, obviously have loved ones who died as well. And maybe it will resonate with them as well.
No doubt about it. And as I say, condolences to your family on the passing of your brother.
Thanks, Ryan.
And Ryan asked Chris to talk about the story behind his poem, "My Kidney."
There is a part of me concealed that is forever England's to hold. It moves in some stranger through London streets plumbed and sealed. Needs no passport to live in its abode. Lets me walk with a lighter load.
Says it all. But says maybe it all. Maybe give us some context in that. There's a part of you in England. Like
there's a part of me, yeah. So in 2019, I was sitting at home watching the telly and watching the Clare Byrne show, actually.
Very good.
And I saw a colleague of mine in the audience, and you won't mind me mentioning his name because he's on the public record in relation to what he did.
Oh, yes.
So Dominic Nathan, and he's an occupational health physician in the matter. And when I saw him in the audience, I said, what's Dominic doing there? Because I kind of know him. And he was a few years behind me in college, and I bump into a medical dude, and our daughters were in the same class. So I kind of know him socially as well. And I thought he must be there to talk about some kind of medical controversy, because like when there are doctors in the audience, it's usually over some kind of crisis in the medical, in the health services. So I was wondering, what are they going to ask Dominic about? So in the second half of the show, she came down to him and asked him about kidney donation. And he was there with a nephrologist from Beaumont, and he told the story that he'd actually donated a kidney to somebody he didn't know in Belfast. And I was amazed at this because I didn't know about it, and I knew him. So after the show, I sent him a text and I arranged to meet him. And I met him a few weeks later in the matter, and I said, God, I've been just thinking about that. And like I'd kind of done lots of operations. I'd never been sick at all. I had never thought of donation apart from the card that, you know, I signed, that in the event of, yes, you know, an RTA and like I'm deceased, to donate my kidney. But I never really thought of beyond that. So he told me that he'd given a kidney to somebody that he didn't know in Belfast. The legislation is in the pipeline in relation to that type of altruistic anonymous donation here. And it was a really positive experience. And like, he didn't encourage me to pursue it, but it just kept kind of growing around in my head. And he gave me some bump and contact details. And I discussed it at home. It kept playing on my mind that, like, I've been healthy up to now. There's nobody in the family who has a kidney disease. I've done lots of surgery in the past. I'm coming up to retirement. And I just thought, I think I might like to do that. So I mentioned it at home. And so kind of my wife and daughter said, no, they were just concerned over the risk that this would pose to me and, you know, giving away a kidney that you didn't need to give away. Interestingly, my sons, and I suppose there's a difference maybe between sons and daughters, my sons were saying, go for it, Dad, which didn't necessarily, wasn't the right thing as well. Yeah. So they're saying, go for it. So I went up to Belfast and had an assessment. I spoke to the people up there. And so there was an opportunity to give a kidney, and I passed the assessment. I thought they'd say I'm too old, and they said, no, you're the right age. You've paid your mortgage. You've written your will, and the risks are very low. And I suppose the other thing it was part of a sequence of there's a kidney sharing scheme in the UK whereby I donated my kidney to a person who had no match in their immediate circle, say their family. And one of their family members donated their kidney to somebody who's in a similar situation.
Yes, it's like a domino chain.
It was a domino. Yes, so there were basically, it was one in a sequence of three donations and three recipients. So I went up to Belfast, and Belfast City I love, and I had the operation in early January. And then I was back to work in 4 weeks' time. And I was due a little bit of time off, and I just basically told my immediate family and some colleagues at work. I didn't tell everyone about it. And then not long after coming back, COVID happened. And I was into a completely different kind of scenario. And then a couple of weeks later, I got a letter from the person who'd received the kidney. And it was a delightful letter to receive, just saying that they'd been in bad shape beforehand, and that they had come through the operation and the kidney was working. And I suppose the nice thing for me was they were actually from London. Now, I had no idea where the kidney was going, and I had no other details other than they lived in London. And London's a city I love. It was one of the last places I visited before the travel restrictions, one of the first places I visited when the restrictions were lifted. I've always felt particularly at home there. And I suppose the other, I suppose, slightly ironic thing, that this was happening around the time of Brexit. So at the time when, you know, there were issues in terms of borders and moving north and south and north and south. And I remember saying to the nephrologist in Belfast, like, I'm from Dublin and I'm giving the kidney in Belfast and it's going to the UK.
Yeah.
Is there any issue over Brexit? And she said, not at all. Forget about it. And that was actually nice.
Yes.
And we come to Sir Alec Guinness and the life lesson Chris received as a young doctor.
Oh, the only thing I ever wanted to do in school was actually to study English.
Yeah.
And I had the benefit. I went to CBS North Brunswick Street, Brunner, the school around the corner. And I had this succession of absolutely fantastic school teachers, particularly in relation to English, all the way through. Like, I had a brother, Martin, in fifth class in the primary, who had his reading John B. Keane, Gerard Manley Hopkins and Shakespeare. And they're three that you wouldn't necessarily put
amazing,
together. So a very kind of a broad liberal education in relation to English literature. So that's all I wanted to do. I went to university, UCD, to study English. Then I smashed my leg in a soccer match just before I did the degree and ended up going into Vincent's and just down the road. And I'd never been in hospital before at all. And I was in hospital for about a week and then I was in and out. It took a while for the fracture to heal. I had kind of this thing called delayed union. So I was in and out of Vincent's and I suddenly became fascinated with medicine. And it was a system of knowledge you knew absolutely nothing about. And I was looked after by some amazing doctors, nurses, physiotherapists. And I was really kind of impressed by, I suppose, the people that they were. And in particular, I was looked after by a junior doctor. And it was a guy that I'd actually seen play from Hill 16 on many an occasion. So the junior doctor who looked after him was David Hickey.
Mm.
So, and David was one of the stars of the Dublin football team. So, and he was the intern, the junior doctor looking after me. And I said, actually, I think I'd like to be like him because he was a really nice guy. He was very charismatic. He was very caring. I said, well, I'm never actually going to be able to play football like him. So maybe I might like to be a doctor like him. So I finished the degree. I applied to do medicine. And then I kind of put the poetry and the novels and the theatre basically on the back burner for about 10 years.
Did you fall out of love with them?
I kind of did. I began to feel it's not really that relevant. So like medicine is relevant because you're caring for, you're healing people, you're fixing things. It's kind of fact-based, it's evidence-based. And whereas poetry and novels, it's kind of the creative imagination. You're kind of making it up. So naively, I thought it was less important.
Okay.
And so about 10 years later, and I've kind of gone through medical school, I'm a junior doctor, I'm working in the Rotunda, and I'm at a conference in Italy, and I'm standing about to hand in my key at the reception desk. I'm staying in the hotel where the conference is.
Yes.
And there's a man standing in front of me and I recognised the back of his head. And the reason I did was because I'd seen him in countless movies throughout my life. And so my dad, who's listening in here, my dad's a huge film buff. So when we were kids, he would plonk us down in the settee when there was ever a Hollywood movie or an old British movie from the 30s, 40s, 50s. So I'd seen this guy in countless movies. And his name was Alec Guinness.
Oh.
So he turned around and I suppose you get this all the time, Ryan, where, like people who know you from the screen, from the television, they think they know you personally. So I stepped towards him and said, Sir Alec, great to see you. And rather than shying away, he actually came towards me, shook my hand.
Lovely.
So I had this chat and I'd just seen him on, he'd done the BBC serialisation of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. So we played George Smiley. So big conversation about that. And so after about 20 minutes, he said, look, why don't you join myself and my wife for dinner tonight?
Oh, good Lord.
So, so over dinner that night, and I was, once again, like the kid in the sweet shop, saying to him, like, what was it like to be in the Bridge and the River Kwai? And you played opposite Audrey Hepburn and, all the movies he'd been in. And I said, God, my father would just so love to be here with me to share in this. And he was very reluctant to talk about himself. And he kept asking me about like the most uninteresting person in the room. Me, he kept saying like, where'd you go to school? And, and when he heard that I'd actually studied English at university, he said, and that I'd actually kind of packed it in. Like I was interested in the movies and music and sport, but I'd stopped reading the poetry and the novels, etc. He said, oh no, you need to go back and you need to start reading poetry and you need to go to the theatre and you need to be a more rounded person than the person you are. And you need to be able to see the world through the eyes of your patient. And if you're a doctor, you need to be able to visualize how life is for them. You need to connect more. You need to be able to find the right words. And then you need to be able to escape from yourself. So I was kind of like, this was kind of life coaching. And I skipped a couple of the sessions in the concert, in the conference afterwards just to meet him. And I remember at the very end, Ryan, of the conference, you did this evaluation about like what you thought and what you learned. So I said, I'll probably get into trouble over this, but I said, actually, the best thing about this conference is actually meeting Alec Guinness. And I learned more from him than anyone else.
Dr. Chris Fitzpatrick from the Ryan Tubridy Show. And on the Ray Darcy Show, our Eurovision hope rests this year with Brooke Scullion. And she was talking to Ray in the afternoon.
We're going live now to Turin
to say hello to Brooke Scullion. That's a big build-up, yeah, Brooke. No pressure. How are you?
I had to listen to that whole song. That's about maybe the 600th time I've heard it.
I was thinking about that when I was playing it out, actually. I'm wondering, is Brooke enjoying that, or is she singing along, or what's she doing?
I was practicing my dance, so it's all good. I appreciated it. I really did.
Were you practicing your dance in your head, or actually moving around the place?
Moving. Yes. Yeah, my dancers are behind me laughing. Yes. They say, go on, work.
I'd say it's second nature now, is it, the dance moves?
Well, the choreographer keeps changing it, Emer.
Does she?
I'm shouting back at her here. Yeah.
Well, tell her to stop. Tell her to stop. You need to be concentrating on your singing. That's the important thing. Listen, it's great to finally talk to you. I think I've been following the Eurovision for a long, long time, that this is our best chance of getting to the final in a long, long time. Thank you so much. Well, no pressure. But
no, do you know what? I need pressure.
Do you need pressure? Okay.
Not really.
Because it just hops off the radio there. And I see, I don't know if you know this, but after your second rehearsal got a lot of attention online, the number of streams on Spotify has gone up by nearly 25%.
That's insane, isn't it? I know.
So people and that often happens, doesn't it, Brooke? You probably know this, you've been talking to people, but a lot happens in the week of the Eurovision.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you know, I know that whenever I was watching the Eurovision when I was younger and up until now, it's been on the night. I never really followed the whole journey, but everything's happening this week, I tell you that much. Everything is crazy. I was walking a red carpet, well, it was a blue carpet, yesterday. And it's just something every day. It's crazy. It's an amazing experience.
Yeah, yeah. You have to mind yourself, and particularly mind your voice.
Oh, yeah, no, I've been on vocal rest all day. You're lucky you get to speak to me.
Oh, no, thank you very much. I believe you take the vocal rest so seriously that you carry around a whiteboard. Is that true?
How did you know? Oh, yes, I do. Yes. I do know that. Yes, How did you know that?
Ah, there you go. We do our research. So when somebody asks you a question, you write it down. Yeah.
Do you know what? It's actually really cool because people listen a lot more intently to your response. They're waiting on it. They hang on your every word.
it's true. And I had an auntie Anne, and lovely woman. She's still alive, not had her, she's still alive. But she whispers and she reckons you get a lot more attention from people when you lower your voice.
Well, that's probably true, but whispering apparently is very bad for your voice. I've only learned how to sing working with other singers recently.
Right, I didn't know that. So whispering isn't good for your voice, right?
No, and you're also not allowed to drink cold water. You have to drink warm water.
Right, what else do you need to do?
Apparently, a lot more things that I'm not doing.
Right.
Brooke Scullion from The Ray D'Arcy Show. Now, we often hear of the historic Roe versus Wade case in America. On Today with Claire Byrne, Claire was asking, who was Jane Roe?
In 1973, Roe versus Wade secured a woman's legal right to obtain an abortion in the United States. But now, almost half a century later, a leaked document indicates a majority of US Supreme Court justices plan to support overturning the historic ruling. The draft decision isn't final, but both the potential ruling and the leaking of the document are stirring up new controversy. What we want to look at is, who was the woman at the centre of that case in the 70s? Who was Jane Roe? And how and why did she transform abortion rights? Terry Sheridan is news director with WSHU Public Radio, and he joins me on the line now. Terry, thank you for joining us. You're very welcome to the programme.
And thank you, and good morning, Claire.
So Jane Roe was a pseudonym for a woman called Norma McCorvey, and she waived her right to anonymity after she won her case. Tell us a little bit about the beginning of her life. It was a very tough start.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was a very sad and tough life. She became pregnant when she was 16. She was married when she was 16, someone that she met while she was working as a waitress in a restaurant in Texas. She gave birth to that child and had a relationship with her, Melissa. Now, shortly after, she divorced Mr. McCorvey, and she became pregnant again. She gave that baby up for adoption. In 1969, she became pregnant for a third time and sought an illegal abortion in Texas because there was very restrictive laws at that time. She couldn't get an illegal abortion, but an adoption agency pointed her to two lawyers who would help her with the case to perhaps allow her to get an abortion. She filed suit in federal court saying that her right to privacy was being denied. The federal court agreed. What happened then was the Texas Attorney General appealed. That's how it got to the Supreme Court in 1973. She did give birth to that third child, put up for adoption. One of the ironies is that Norma McCorvin never had an abortion.
And how old was she when all of this happened, when she decided to bring the case against the state of Texas?
She was probably 19 years old. She was 16 when she gave birth to probably 20 years old, back in 1969.
Okay, and she, when she went to this agency and they sent her to these two lawyers, can you tell me about the two lawyers and where they had come from?
Well, they were recent graduates from the University of Texas Law School who were working to overturn Texas restrictive abortion laws at the time, back in the late 60s. There were only a few states in the United States that allowed abortion. What they decided was, or what they were looking for, was a woman who was poor and who could not travel, for instance, say, from Texas to New York. So they took on the case. They thought that she was, you know, end quotes, the perfect client because she was poor. And they used her for the case.
Mm-hmm. And we hear, Terry, about Roe versus Wade. Who was Wade? Who were they up against?
Henry Wade was the district attorney of Dallas County. That is where Norma lived. So that was what the case was. He originally was suing Henry Wade. Henry Wade then took the case to the United States Supreme Court.
So what happened then in the case? As you say, Norma had her child because obviously this case was going to take much longer than her pregnancy. But what happened eventually in the abortion case?
Well, what happened was that the United States Supreme Court ruled that due to the 14th Amendment right to privacy, that the states could not make a law banning abortion past a certain point. Now, that certain point has been the topic of discussion for these past 50 years. At what point is a baby viable outside of a mother's womb? At what point is it still a fetus? Now, again, that's the moving target that's been happening for the past 50 years and where most of the discussion has been, whether it's 15 weeks, whether it's 26 weeks, whether it's up to the moment of viability and birth.
Was she still involved, though, when this case went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1973?
Yes, she was. She was an active participant in that. And then afterwards, you know, through the 1970s and through the 1980s, She was an abortion activist.
Mm-hmm. But initially, in the 70s, she remained anonymous. Did she? When did she agree to give up her anonymity?
In the early 1980s. Okay. In the early 1980s, she came forward, and then throughout the 1980s, she was an activist and appeared at several abortion rights rallies and abortion rights conferences.
So she came back into the public domain and she attended these abortion rights marches, but then she changed her view. Do we know what happened, Terry?
Well, not exactly, because this is where the story gets murky. We do know that in the early 1990s, she converted and became an evangelical Christian, and then she became part of Operation Rescue, which was a notorious, and I use that word seriously, operation, anti-abortion operation, which would threaten providers who were doing abortion. He then converted again to Catholicism and became a very active anti-abortion spokesperson. She would show up at rallies, she would show up in churches, and she would be talking about how bad abortion was and how bad her experience was.
Yeah, it was a very strange thing, though, because she herself had been a target of the anti-abortion faction, hadn't she?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because, again, she was the Jane Roe. And, in fact, because the leaders of Operation Rescue actually opened up their headquarters next to the abortion clinic where she was working in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm. And what about this twist then on her deathbed in 2017?
Well, in a movie called AKA Jane Roe, she said that she never really gave up her her feelings for abortion rights, that she only became an anti-abortion activist for the money. Now, we do know that she did receive over $400,000 in the 90s through various events that she went to for various jobs that she did. But she said, they played me, I played them. You know, they used me because, you know, they had their trophy. I used them to get all this money.
Terry Sheridan from Today with Claire Byrne. And after Michelle McGowan called Jo about donating one of her kidneys to a stranger, the importance of donors dominated the Liveline. This is Will's story.
Basically, my story is the start of this year, I had a kidney and pancreas transplant.
Okay.
So
Is that as big as it sounds? It's
big surgery. I'm flying after it now, to be honest.
Great.
I was a diabetic for 27 years. I'm 41 now, but my diabetes is gone. I have a normal life again. My kidney is functioning. Luckily, I hadn't started dialysis. I was about to. Mm-hmm. And I got the call to get up to St. Vincent's because they had matches for me. So okay. I had a double transplant in. And since then, I see a future in my life. You know, it's I'm always a very positive person anyway. Mm. But I actually see a future. You know, it's amazing. Like my sister wanted to go, my sister Rona, she wants to go as a to get tested to be a kidney donor for me. But since I was going for a kidney and pancreas,
yeah,
my best option would have been from a deceased person. Yeah. So I feel I owe my life to that family, and I'm going to be able to write to them anonymously at some stage. And it's something I just can't wait to do, to let them know how their loved one is after.
Difference it made to you, I know it's a few months ago, but the difference it has made so far?
I feel so much better in myself. Now, there was a few hiccups and stuff like that at the start, and like the whole transplanting went very smoothly, but little infections afterwards and things like that. But other than that, in Vincent's, they were absolutely fantastic to me. My surgeon, Tom Gallagher, an amazing man. And then there was the transplant coordinators, Susie and Caroline, they were absolutely fantastic to me. I owe my life to them as well. Like it's just like since it was a double transplant and the pancreas and things like that, it's done in the people from Beaumont to come over to Vincent's and they do the surgery in Vincent's.
How long were you under? How long was the operation?
About 11 hours. Whatever day I got the call, it was about 5:30 in the evening telling me to get myself to Dublin. So I packed the suitcase fast, got on the train, and I was in Dublin that night for 9:30, at the hospital for about 10, and they were retrieving the organs from the donor and to test them. And then I got a phone, then they came in about 5:00 in the morning saying, yeah, the organs are good, you're going down at 7 in the morning.
That's Will on the Live Line with Joe Duffy. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself, till next time.